2. His memories of childhood were fathomless, dateless, all place and no time, the rooms of the house, the floorboards of the stair landing, the blue ringed plates, the fetlocks of a great horse standing at the smithy, his mother's hand, sunlight on gravel, rain on water, the outlines of the mountains against dark winter sky. Among these, one time was distinct, that time when he stood in a room lit by 4 candles and saw a head on a pillow, the eye sockets, pits of black, the large nose shining like metal, and a hand lay on the quilt, but did not move, as if it were not a hand, but a thing. A voice kept murmuring. It was his grandfather's room, but his grandfather was not there. His uncle Emmanuel cast a huge shadow that moved behind him on the wall. There were huge shadows behind all the people, the servants, the priest, his mother. He was afraid to look at them. The murmur of the priest's voice was like water lapping up the walls of the room, higher and higher, singing in his ears, closing over his head. He began to gasp for breath. In suffocating terror and shadow, he had felt a big hand touch his back, and his father had said quietly, "You're here too, Itale?" And his father had taken him out of the room and told him to play in the garden a while. He had run out gladly, discovering that outside the room with the candles it was not even dark yet. The bronze of sunset still glowed on the lake, the humped back of the mountain called the Hunter over Evalde Gulf, the peak of San Lorenz in the high west. His little sister Laura had been put to bed. He stayed out alone and did not know what to do. He tried the door of the tool house, but it was locked. He picked up a reddish stone from the path and whispered to himself, "I am Itale. I am 7 years old." But he was not sure of that. A child wandering in a garden in the broad, dark wind of night, lost, lost, until at last his aunt Pernetta came scolding and reassuring and hurried him off to bed. Itale Sorde, the grandfather, had lived in France in the 1770s and had traveled in Germany and Italy. His neighbors of Val Malafrena slowly forgave him, though some of them never trusted him again. At 40, he had returned for good to the mountain province and to his wife, a cousin of his neighbor Count Guido Valtorskar, had improved his estate, rebuilt his house, and settled down. He sent his sons down to Solari to college, but both returned without further divagation to the Montaigne, the elder to run the estate, and the younger to practice law, moderately, in Portaceca. Their father never left the province after 1790. Over the years, his correspondence with friends abroad had slowly decreased, then stopped. They were dead, or had forgotten him, or knew he had chosen to be forgotten. After his death in 1810, he was remembered for his good management of the estate, his stately kindness, his skill as a gardener. The family was of the Dome, the commoner landowner class, which had in 1740 been granted by royal charter equal privilege with the nobles of the kingdom. In the eastern provinces, the Dome still stood outside the old social hierarchy, insulated off. In the center and west, they had, with the burghers of the capital and the major cities, become more closely engrafted with the nobility by intermarriage and custom than convention permitted most people to admit, more numerous and potentially more influential than most of them realized themselves. The magic of names still held minds enchanted. The Dome did not have names. They had property. Domitale's property was small, but excellent. The house he built there looked out on 3 sides on the lake. It stood on a blunt peninsula, the end of a ridge running down from the shoulder of San Givan Mountain. The steep ridge was crowned with native oak and pine, so that approached from the east, the house seemed to stand alone in a somber sweep of lake and mountain. But coming from Portaceca, the town in the pass, one saw the fields and orchards and vineyards, the peasants' and leaseholders' houses, the roofs of other manors. The estate raised wine grapes, pears, apples, rye, oats, barley. It was a dramatic but not a harsh climate. In a hard winter, snow lay deep on the forested peaks, but not for a century had the ice frozen across Malafrena or the other lakes that stretched in a chain along the mountains to the southwest border of the land. Summers were long and hot, and thunderstorms roamed growling among the mountains. The years were marked by drought or great rain, vintage, weather, harvest, rather than by the events of history, whether King Stefan ruled, or Napoleon and Grand Duke Matthias, or Francis and Grand Duchess Maria. It did not much affect the weather and the earth, the flavor of the wine, the aspects of the hills. Landowners and their tenants lived wholly within the mountain barrier. Taxation they grumbled at, so had their great-grandfathers. Guida Sorda, the inheritor, was a tall man, spare, dark, with acute gray eyes, a good type of the taciturn peasants of his province, from whom his ancestors had risen to be landowners in the 17th century. His wife, Eleonora, born in Solari on the southern plain, was the only thing he had found outside the mountains that he prized, and he brought her back with him for good. In 1803, their son was born, their daughter 3 years later. Eleonora taught both children until Itale was 11 and Laura 8. Then, since education had got to be a tradition in the family and Guida upheld all traditions, a tutor began to come in thrice a week for Laura, and Itale went off to school with the Benedictines on Sinvia Mountain. He came home most weekends. It was only 7 miles. On the Thursday half-holiday, he would go down to Portaceca, whose peaked slate roofs and climbing streets lay under the windows of the monastery school, and have dinner with his uncle Emmanuel and his aunt Pernetta in their high wooden house with its garden full of marigolds, pansies, phlox, and its view over the dark streets and roofs out through the pass. The town was set in a deep gap between Sinvia and San Givan Mountains. Framed by the towering slopes, Portaceca's northward view had a quality of vision. It seemed as if the shadowed pass could not lead out to those remote and sunlit azure hills, but only look down on them as if on fabled kingdoms across the barrier of possibility. When clouds gathered full of thunder on the peaks and hung low over the town, sometimes the view of the lower hills shone out in a clear golden light, an enchanted realm, free of the storm and darkness of the heights. Idling by the Golden Lion Inn, Itale saw the coaches of the southwestern post set off for distant cities, or come in, high, swaying, dusty, from their journeys. And Portaceca, the gateway of his province, had for him the glamour of voyage and the unknown that a seaport has for one whose country's border is the sea. Saturdays at noon he walked down through town, through the oak-wooded rolling foothills, past the slopes of vine and orchard, to the house by the lake. On the way he might meet and stop with his friends among the boys of the estate, or stop and talk with Brone, the master vintner, a long-legged, high-shouldered, grim old man. He would ask and tell Brone all the events of the week. If they were mishaps, Brone would say, "So things go." And if triumphs, "Aye, but works certain, and rewards seldom, Dom Ital." When he was 17, the monks of Sinvia sent him home with blessings and a first prize in Latin, and he took up the life of a young landowner, learning how to prune grape stocks and drain fields and keep accounts, hunting, riding, sailing his boque Falcone on the lake. The work filled his time, but not his mind. He got restless. An important person to his family, he felt he ought to do something important. Status was obligation, that he had learned from his father, who never talked about duty, but autocrat as he was, served it unquestioning. Seeking a worthy duty, the boy studied the lives of great men. Aeneas had been his first hero. His grandfather had told him the story. Then he had read it in school, in his father's battered school copy. But he found others in the meager lot of books he could get. Pericles, Socrates, Hector, Hannibal. And there was Napoleon. His childhood passed under the empire, his boyhood during the exile. Powerless on his island jail, defeated, humiliated, Napoleon loomed there like Prometheus in chains, while over the broad lands of Europe and Russia ruled little, apprehensive kings. Note. According to the Greek poet Hesiod, the Titan Prometheus, creator of mankind, was imprisoned by the gods for his theft of fire on man's behalf. His punishment was to be chained to a rock and to have an eagle eat his liver every day, which would then regenerate overnight. He was eventually freed by Hercules. End note. In his grandfather's library, the 17-year-old found so many French books that, enlisting his sister's willing aid, for she was being tutored in French, he taught himself enough of the language to be able to read Voltaire. Laura tried to read with him, but found it boring, and returned to her mother's favorite, the new Eloise, at which Itale was relieved, since at the monastery school Voltaire had been mentioned only in the same breath with the devil, and he was not quite sure what he was getting into. Note. Julie ou la Nouvelle Héloïse, 1761, by French writer and philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712-1778, a novel in letter form in which Rousseau propounded many of his ideas about freedom and the authentic life. End note. There were some odd volumes of the Moniteur, the French government newspaper. Note. La Gazette Nationale ou le Moniteur Universal, newspaper founded in 1789 in Paris that reported on the debates in the National Assembly during the Revolution. It later became a propaganda organ for Napoleon I and continued publication until 1868. End note. He looked at one from 1809 and found it like all newspapers he had ever seen, the mouthpiece of authority. But later he chanced on a volume from the early 1790s. He did not at first recall what had been going on in Paris then. The monks had not been strong on recent history. He came on speeches made by Monsieur Danton, Monsieur Mirabeau, Monsieur Vergniaud. They were strangers to him. Note. Georges Jacques Danton, 1759-1794, Honoré Gabriel Riquetti, Comte de Mirabeau, 1749-1791, and Pierre-Victurnien Vergniaud, 1753-1793, leading figures in the French Revolution who opposed the radical Jacobin faction led by Maximilien Robespierre, 1758-1794. Danton and Vergniaud were executed during the Jacobin Terror, while Mirabeau died of natural causes. End note. Monsieur Robespierre he had heard mentioned, along with Voltaire and the devil. He turned back to the year 1790 and began reading steadily. He held the French Revolution in his hands. He read the speech in which the orator called down the wrath of the people on the House of Privilege, the speech that ended, Vivre libre ou mourir, live free or die. Note, French revolutionary slogan, plausibly uttered by Vergniaud, live free or die. End note. The yellowed newsprint crumbled under the boy's touch. His head was bowed over dry columns of words spoken to a lost assembly by men 30 years dead. His hands felt cold, as if a wind blew on him. His mouth was dry. He did not understand half what he read, knowing almost nothing of the events of the revolution. It did not matter. He understood that there had been a revolution. The speeches were full of rant, cant, and vanity. He saw that clearly enough. But they discussed freedom as a human need, like bread, like water. Itale got up and walked up and down the quiet little library, rubbing his head and staring blankly at the bookcases and the windows. Freedom was not a necessity. It was a danger. All the lawmakers of Europe had been saying that for a decade. Men were children, to be governed for their own good by the few who understood the science of government. What did this Frenchman Vergniaud mean by stating a choice, live free or die? Such choices are not offered to children. The words were spoken to men. They rang bald and strange. They lacked the logic of statements made in support of alliances, counter-alliances, censorships, repressions, reprisals. They were not reasonable. Itale came late to supper, looking feverish. He ate little, and soon escaped the house, going down to the lake shore in the darkness. There, he wrestled for some hours with the angel, the messenger who had challenged him that afternoon. He put up the best fight he could, since, for a 19-year-old, he regarded clear thinking highly. But the angel won hands down. Itale could not refuse what he had wanted and sought— the ideal of human greatness, not embodied in a person, but to be won for all by the fellowship of mankind. So long as one soul is unjustly jailed, I am not free, thought the new convert. And when he thought of these things, his face took on a stern expression, and also a look of great happiness. His 20th year was in fact the happiest of his life. When out of long silence he would reply to something his mother said, she would look at him wistfully and wonder where it was he had been, so far from her that his blue eyes looked at her with joyous recognition, as if he had been long away in distant lands. She knew before he did that he wanted to leave home. He found it out for himself that summer. When his work was done, he would take his boat and run the shining lake, returning at dusk from the farthest eastern gulfs, where the river Chiasa sprang from the lake and started down the forested mountainsides to the foothills and the plains, to join the Molsen and run on with it. The stream he watched chasing down amongst the rocks would, by summer's end, have reached the sea, while he stayed home by the still lake. Guide Sorde was told that it was natural for a young man to want to leave home for a while, but he saw it as mere folly. The estate had to be run. Itale was the heir. If one had a job, one did it. Eleonora, following her brother-in-law's suggestion, had proposed sending Itale to college in Solari.
After all, your father sent you and Emmanuel there.
There's nothing there he needs,
said Guide in his quiet voice, in which one could hear, like a wind blowing from the edge of distant storm, a muted resonance of passion.
Waste of time.
Eleonora had never combated her husband's arrogant provincialism for herself, but for Itale she did.
He needs to meet people, to know the world a little. What good will he be to his peasants if he's no more than another peasant?
Guide scowled. His wife was using his own weapons against him more cleverly than he could use them, and he felt, besides, that he had not been able to express his real reason for not wanting to let the boy go. He was angry at his family for not understanding this motive which he did not understand himself, and offended because he knew he must give in. Everybody knew he would give in, even Itale. Only Eleonora had the tact to argue with him. So, in September of 1822, Itale set off on the Montaigne diligence, northward, through the pass, and down. Looking back, he saw the mountains above, long rising ranges of foothills, their familiar outlines changed and changing. San Givan had revealed a great falling eastern slope, Sinvia, a second peak, The faint blue outline beyond them, the farthest away, must be the hunter. As it sank out of sight, Itale got out his watch, his grandfather's silver watch, and checked the hour, 9:20 of the morning. Here, on the descending road, now bending towards the southeast, it was sunny. Crickets sang in the mown fields. Harvesters were at work. The villages were deserted, tranquil in the sunlight. It was the golden land he had seen from beneath the storm clouds of Portaceca. They passed through towns and villages whose names he knew from hearsay. Vermare, Chaga, Bara. With the last, they left the Montaina province, and at Ereme he changed to the Sudana post. He looked intently at the people, the houses, the chickens and pigs, as the Sudana post rolled along, to see what pigs, chickens, houses, people looked like down here. In Solari, all things were sleepy. Livestock was fat, houses drowsed in their overgrown gardens full of roses. Even the Molsen slept as it flowed through Solari under the old bridge, sending its wide flood slow and shining to the south. The students of the university did not work hard. They did not duel. They drank a lot of wine and fell in love continually, and the girls of Solari fell in love with them. In his second year, Itale, abandoned by a faithless baker's daughter, renounced love violently and turned to politics. He became a leader in the student society, Amictia. The government was barely tolerant of Amictia. All such student groups had been outlawed in the Germanies. A society at the University of Vilna so aggravated the Tsar of all the Russias that in 1824 he disbanded it, exiled the boys that led it, and put the entire student body and faculty under permanent surveillance. Note: University of Vilna, founded in 1579, in Vilnius, in Polish, Vilna, Lithuania. End note. It was this sort of thing that gave Amictia its spice. They drank a lot of wine and sang the society's forbidden anthem, "Beyond this darkness is the light, O liberty of thine eternal day." They passed contraband books around, discussed the revolutions of France, Naples, Piedmont, Spain, Greece, talked of constitutional monarchy, equality before the law, popular education, a free press, all without any clear idea of what they were getting at, where it all led. They were not supposed to talk, so they talked. So the third year passed, and Itale thought himself ready to go home for good, until he found himself half-shod and laughing in the dark court of the chapel, until he heard Frenin saying in the sunlight over the river, "I'm thinking of Krasnoy."